Queen Carvania stood haloed by the morning sun. An army hung on her every word.
My champions, I have sold my chariot on Carvana. 'Twas a lovely SUV, an inexplicably queenly offer. They're even coming to the castle to collect it. Tonight, we feast!
An offer you can feast on. Sell your car today on Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
Welcome to the D Word Podcast, where we talk dementia. Good to have your company once again here on the D Word Podcast. The links between sport and dementia is a subject that we've been following for a while. While we've talked about football, on this edition we turn the focus to rugby as I welcome Rich and Jen Coates from the charity Marshalling CTE. Well, Jen and Rich, it's a real pleasure to welcome you as my guests here on the D-Word, co-founders of Marshalling CTE. Regular listeners to the programme will know that the connections between certain sports and dementia is something that we've been following for quite a time now on the show. And it's always great to talk with two people that are involved in that area. I'll start with you, Rich. Obviously, you know, rugby was your sport and you started at a very young age, didn't you?
I did indeed. I started at 7 years old. Obviously, it was full contact back then at that age group. It was a interesting time, I suppose.
I suppose if you started at seven and kind of progressed through, how many games were you playing, sort of a week or something like that?
So at that age, it was literally once a week on a Sunday. As I progressed through, it's probably about 15, I think, roughly, 15, 16. My wife, Jen, and I sat down and worked out that some weeks I was playing up to five games a week for different clubs, i.e. county, district, southwest, local clubs, school, so on and so forth. And I just think that's took its toll, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, rugby's the way both of you met, isn't it?
It is indeed, yeah. I worked behind the bar at my local rugby club for a number of years, and I was also the first aider for the boys whenever they got injured on the pitch. That's interesting. but Rich was playing for a rival team and he came to play at our ground and he defected there and then, didn't you? You defected to our team so that he'd get to know me.
a mutual friend, wasn't it? Convinced me to come down.
Yeah, so yeah, he left our rival team to come and play for us. And a year later, we started dating and got married really quickly and been together since.
Yeah,
that's some way to arrange a transfer, isn't it? That's definitely. Concentrate on it. I mean, you know, you were doing all that, Rich, you were playing all those games, a lot of contacts, and then suddenly you got to a stage where you felt you needed to see someone about what was happening and possibly get a diagnosis of something. I mean, take me through, kind of, you know, what was the thoughts behind all of that?
So, as Jen said, when we got together, that's when I think I was first starting to see signs that something wasn't quite right.
Before
we got together, I was very impulse controlled and wasn't there, heavily drinking, but I literally put it down to the culture of rugby. You know, we have the game, then we all have a couple of beers after and talk about things like that. But I think, like I said, when it really started to hit home was probably a year or two after Jen and I got together. We both started noticing things, but didn't really know what it was. I started suffering really badly with depression and anxiety. And that manifested then into more drinking. I was getting voices in my head and I couldn't make sense of what was going on. Fast forward to, what, four years ago?
3 years ago, started to see memory problems.
Yeah, and I saw something on Facebook and I actually thought it was a study into concussions for players now to make the game safer. So I filled in all the stuff, got a phone call and was actually told that it was for a litigation. So they sent me for all the testing, and when we finally got the results back and the diagnosis, everything made sense. The memory, the mood, the rage, the drinking, impulse control, so many other things that we hadn't even put together. And yeah, that's basically how I got my diagnosis. And since then, we've just been looking for answers and treatment and so on and so forth for what can help with what we've got.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I think you're 41, if I'm right in thinking. When
you I'm were 42 now.
Yeah, so, you know, very early, very young to be diagnosed with early onset dementia, probable CTE. I mean, Jen, how much did you know about those things while Rich was going through all that and when he got the diagnosis?
Well, I knew quite a lot about dementia. I mean, my granddad had Alzheimer's and vascular dementia, and I helped my mum when I could for caring for him. And I also worked in the care industry for a while, so I was used to dealing with people with dementia, but I had never in a million years realised that there was such a thing as young dementia, early onset dementia. So didn't even think for a second that that's what it could be. But when we got the diagnosis, and I read all the reports and then I read a bit into what CTE is, it was like a light bulb moment. It was like, this all makes sense now. He's changing his personality, his behavior. I mean, he was driving me nuts because I'd say things like, I've already told you this. And he's like, no, you haven't. And I'm like, yes, I have. And we didn't argue over it, but it was annoying that I had to keep repeating myself. But now I know it wasn't his fault. It's brain injury, it's dementia, and it all made sense. And it allowed me to understand what was going on and be more supportive and realise that it's not his fault. He's not just being forgetful on purpose. He's got, I think the scariest time was when we realised that he shouldn't be driving anymore. So he was a courier. So he was driving all over the country. But one day he phoned me in a state of panic because he couldn't remember how to get home. I mean, he's lived in Gloucester
near enough
his whole life. And he was in Cheltenham, which is basically a straight road from Cheltenham to our village. And he couldn't remember, even though the sat nav was telling him where to go, he didn't believe it. He just couldn't make head and tail of it. And I had to stay on the phone with him and direct him home to get him home safely. That's when I realised that there was a problem with his driving and ultimately had to give his business up. So, yeah, it was a big shock, but at the same time, it was, in a way, a relief to know what's wrong with him.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Queen Carvania stood haloed by the morning sun. An army hung on her every word.
My champions, I have sold my chariot on Carvana. 'Twas a lovely SUV, an inexplicably queenly offer. They're even coming to the castle to collect it. Tonight, we feast!
An offer you can feast on. Sell your car today on Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Coming up on the D-Word podcast in the next few months, we're going to be finding out about the great strides on dementia awareness being made in Wales, hearing about the work of the Schlatel Research Institute on Ageing in Ontario, and meeting Michael Booth, who's turned his own dementia experience into a new book, Forget Me Not, The Letter in the Headboard. All that to come on the D-Word podcast. This week, though, my guests are Jen and Rich Coates from Marshalling CTE. You know, that's a kind of familiar tale that a lot of people say. But, you know, when you look kind of back on it, Rich, I mean, if someone would have said to you, you know, maybe when you were a teenager or, you know, when you started playing kind of more seriously, that, you know, well, you might be at risk of developing this form of neurodegenerative disease. I guess, you know, that if you play a contact sport like rugby, you're probably used to the fact that you might break something or, you know, your body will take a bit of a pounding. But, you know, would you have still gone ahead playing rugby if someone would have said at age 41 you'd, you know, be in the situation you are now?
We generally have spoken about this a few times. I mean, I still love the sport. It's a difficult one. Like, up until probably a month ago, I was saying I would have still gone on the pitch. I would have done things differently, knowing what I know now. And obviously, if we were told back then that this was a possibility, then I think everybody would have treated it differently. I'd like to think I wouldn't play. Some of the symptoms and the intense migraines, I call them migraines, there's another name for it, but they become that intense that I'm led there, hands on my head, Jen cradling me like a baby, and I'm near enough crying, saying that I can't take the pain anymore. So when I think of those situations, I don't think I'd have ever got on a rugby pitch. But yeah. hindsight is a lovely thing, isn't it?
I think it's more of a case of he would have done things differently, as in, so at the age of 15, he was playing adult rugby. That's a big, shouldn't have happened. It still happens. At grassroots level, and that, I mean, I was trained by the RFU for rugby first aid. We literally spent 2 minutes, if that, on concussions, and it was more about the broken bones and stuff. And they all went into rugby knowing that they're going to end up with knee replacements and hip replacements and possibly a broken back, but nobody was ever told that what could happen from repeated concussions, and nobody was actively stopping them at grassroots level and international, that they need to be rested properly after a concussion. I mean, Rich could get a concussion on the Saturday and then go and play for his school on the Monday because nobody would tell anybody. And to be fair, even if somebody was told, they would still let them play. I mean, I've had loads of arguments with coaches saying, no, they've got a concussion. They're like, yeah, but they weren't knocked out. It doesn't matter that they weren't knocked out. They can't play. And having to actually go over the coaches' heads and go into the ref and going, he's got a concussion, he's not allowed on the pitch now. That's what was happening.
I think possibly in my whole 30 plus years of playing, I think I missed one game with a head injury. I think it was just the one game. But it's wrong. The era that we were playing, and it's still going on today, that it was like, there's no blood. You know, you're not all over the place. You can carry on. But back then, you're getting head injuries and you're on the floor. They bring you the cold water, put it on your head, smelling salts, and give you a couple of minutes to compose yourself. And then you're up and going again. And, you know, a lot of the guys you'll see, they might not talk about it, but they'd go for a shower after a game and you're leaning against the wall and you're seeing basically stars and your vision's not great. And straight away, you're out of the shower, changed, and then at the bar. There's just no really... I can't think of the word.
There was no education or awareness.
Education, yeah, around what's going on. Hmm. I just think it's imperative that, you know, everyone knows the risks.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, we don't want rugby banned.
No, not at all.
I don't know anybody who's played the sport and ended up with this that wants it banned. They just want the awareness there, that people need to be told that not just the broken bones, that you risk your brain as well, and this is how long it takes your brain to basically recover from it and take the appropriate time away from any training or any games. The risk isn't just worth it. Mm-hmm. To just go back onto the field within a couple of days to do training all over again, then there needs to be the awareness, and there needs to be the support, and just make the game safer.
I think, you know, the concept of assumed risk, I guess, comes into this a little bit because, you know, branch off into another sport, Lewis Hamilton would never set foot in a car going at 200 miles an hour unless someone had said to him, well, we've done everything we possibly can to reduce the risk of something nasty happening. But it does seem that, you know, the authorities in a number of sports, not just rugby, football, we've had rodeo riders, NHL, hockey, etc. I mean, you know, when you look back, I've seen your website, by the way, which is absolutely brilliant. If anybody wants to know about CTE, then look at what's written on the website. And we're going back here to 1928 with boxers, where people, you know, first started to notice. Okay, it wasn't the intricate scientific studies. But, you know, that's a long time ago for people to notice that repeated blows to the head are going to cause a problem.
Yeah. And the crazy thing is, it's actually safer to go into boxing than it is any other contact sport, because they've got the concussion protocols and the awareness there. People know going into boxing, there's a good chance you're going to end up messing up your brain and having dementia. But they've got such good protocols and safety around, if anybody of any age, even at the grassroots level, that they get protected. They've even got a thing in place where when you go and join a club, you get signed up onto this website and all your details are on there, including a photo of you. So if you end up with a concussion and you're told that you're not allowed to train, and they go and try and join another gym to get around it, they just look you up and, no, you can't fight, you can't spar, you can't even skip. Why can't we do something like that in all sports? If you want to do a sport that's dangerous, fine, but you need to be protected.
You know, I guess part of the problem with that, Rich, is that all sports at the moment have different protocols. So, you know, and they all seem to treat the scientific evidence differently. Because, you know, we look back to why I'm in the NFL with the Mike Webster case, 2002. You know, everybody should be singing from the same hymn book, shouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, we obviously saw things over here that was going on with the NFL. Me personally, I was looking at it going, oh, maybe they got it because of the helmets, because they're hitting the heads on the helmet and so on and so forth. And I don't think we were educated over here correctly on the repetitive head injuries side of things. It's not the big hits. Yeah, they cause damage. It's the subconcussive hits, the brain hitting the skull and twisting. And I think I don't agree with the way the NFL done things. Yes, they're looking after people now. And I can't see why other sports can't take note from that and move forward and stop the backwards and forwards and the denial. And this is nothing to do with litigation side of things. This is just in the press that player welfare is our main thing. The more we look into that, and anyone could look into that, it's not the case because they're not making these changes.
And I think what's, you know, what's an important point you were making earlier, I think, Jen, he's joining all the levels of the game together, because it's all right putting something in the headline level, but, well, you know, what about all the grassroots players?
Yeah, exactly that. The grass, it's debatable whether the pros and the internationals are being protected enough anyway, but grassroots, there's nothing. I mean, most grassroots levels, they don't even have the first aider that's trained by the RFU. It's just somebody volunteering to do it that hasn't got a clue. The coaches haven't been told and made aware of the dangers of concussion, and that they've got this misconception that you need to be knocked out. And then you've got other people that think that their brains are protected by wearing a scrum cap. I mean, it's all completely bonkers. But
and the idea of a scrum cap was to protect your ears, your cauliflower ears. Yeah. And it does kind of help, I suppose, with lacerations and bleeding and stuff like that. But it's not protecting the brain. There isn't anything out there that protects the brain, because the brain can still move about inside the skull. So obviously these sports are dangerous, and like Jen said, and we reiterate time and time again, we don't want the sports banned. We just need them safer. We need them to look into the amount of contact that's done in training, minimise that, so that teams can go out on a weekend and not be mentally and physically drained from contact sessions. I think it was a Leinster rugby team, going back quite a few years now, they tried a couple of seasons without contact. So they had no contact in their training sessions at all. And at the time, they were one of Europe's best clubs, winning everything. So why is there this need for full contact in training, non-stop scrummaging? I think there just needs to be more research into that side of things as well.
Yeah. Independent research.
Yeah.
Has to be independent research. There's too many research papers out there that have been funded by the sporting governing bodies, and unless you know what you're looking at, you don't realise they've been funded. And the problem is, when they've been funded, they can not change the outcome of what the scientists have done. They can just control the narrative of what is put in the press and what's put in the small papers that go out. That needs to be independent. And like I keep saying, people need to be made aware of the sport dangers.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Always good to hear from you here on the podcast. We're on all the socials as TDW Radio, and the email is tdwradio@gmail.com. Back to my guests now, Jen and Rich from Marshalling CTE. But, you know, I guess people looking on the outside will say, I mean, recently, sadly, we had Gordon McQueen, former Leeds footballer, second-pro footballer, to be judged by a coroner to have suffered an industrial injury, which was responsible for his subsequent dementia. You know, this came, you know, nearly 25 years after the same thing happened with Jeff Astle in 2002. So from that, you know, I talked to friends of mine about this, and they suddenly, you know, they don't know too much about the sports, but logically you think, well, wait a minute, if that happened in 2002, you know, why are they saying they need more evidence?
The thing is, it's a very, it's a dodgy ground, especially for the charity like us to go too far down that road, because there's obviously the litigation things and everything else. But yeah, in regards to, they've known for a while, there could have been changes made. Let's see what comes of everything that's going on at the moment. Hopefully, positively, things will change. And like you said, with Gordon McQueen's inquest now, I think football are going to have to do changes. What's her name? Judith Gates, head say football, is doing wonderful things with that and bringing the no heading in at certain levels. And they're thriving. The game is still awesome. You know, the kids are still enjoying it. Why can't that be transpired into training in professional levels?
Mm.
And I do think eventually that'll come.
Yeah, we had Judith on the show, and, you know, she's doing an amazing job. One of the things is, you know, people have noticed it is starting to, as you say, Rich, you know, people are starting to do things. The only problem is with things like HIA assessments, head injury assessments, sorry, I shouldn't use too many acronyms on the radio, but, you know, when they do bring things in, suddenly they don't seem to be too logical because you've got 10 minutes to decide whether someone's concussed or not.
I could talk to you for hours on this. So I spend my life reading research papers now. So they've brought this HIA in, like you see, and 10 minutes they're meant to figure out whether they've got signs of concussion. But the problem is, first of all, they know what questions are going to be asked of them. They're coached on what the answers are for the questions. People don't realize that it can take 7 to 10 days for a concussion to show any symptoms. So they might not show any symptoms now, but it doesn't mean that their brain's not all swollen up. And there's things out there, like there's saliva rapid tests that are available now that can show the biomarkers if you've got a concussion, and that's within 5 minutes. So why aren't they using those? Well, we know why they're not using those, because they don't want to take all their best players off the pitch and end up with no team. So just make the teams bigger, like the NFL. And then that solves that problem, doesn't it? But the HIAs, the gum shields, the, we call them Mickey Mouse things, that they are using to say, oh, look what we're doing. We're doing something really good, and we're trying to protect the players, because players' welfare is the most important thing. But then when you dig into it, you realise it's just for show. It's not something that is going to really look after the players.
It's very similar with the NFL of a trialing or been trialing, I think it's a halo collar, I think it's called, that they wear on the neck to stop the rapid movements. Now, that's just been proven that it's not doing anything to protect the brain. But the NFL have been selling this, that it's going to do this and do that. And parents, unfortunately, are looking at it going, well, the governing body of this have said that this is helping. So I think, it's like Jen said previously, it's very much, we need more independent research on specific things that can help reduce the impacts. And like I said, reducing heading of the football, reducing contact in training sessions. These are little things, little changes that could make a huge difference moving forwards. So, yeah.
Yeah, I do, you know, and you've set out to do that with the charity, which, yeah, that's a brave move as well. I mean, you two are going through quite a lot here with all of this, and yet you decided we're going to set up a charity. It's not easy, is it?
It didn't start off like that. No. It snowballed.
It snowballed very, very quickly. The idea came about with myself and Roy Heaney got chatting. We met each other on a Facebook page out in America, and just one day we decided to have a phone call. We were like, wouldn't it be amazing if there was something here to support and help and do whatever we can to support the families as well as the players? And the idea was born, and we got talking more and more. Jen came on a couple of calls as well, and the idea just literally snowballed from what we thought we could have a little WhatsApp group and have a chat with people and, you know, support them. They're supporting us, we're there for each other, into this charity of Marshall and CTE that is worldwide. We got people in America, we got people in New Zealand, Canada, from all sports, all walks of life, veterans, domestic violence, professional sporting backgrounds, amateur, you name it, that they've got a brain injury or suspected CTE, dementia. We're talking with all of them. And
yeah,
it can be very full on. But it's so rewarding, and to be able to say that we're helping people in the same situation as us, it's making everything worthwhile. It's given me a purpose now to fight what I'm going through and to help everybody I can.
Yeah, I think it's it's an amazing thing. You should be very proud of what both of you have done in setting up the charity. One thing I did wanted to just mention was that I saw, it kind of took my breath away. I don't know if you've heard about this sport called Run It,
which
basically is two people 20 metres apart then clashing into each other. And suddenly, with everything we know, and we're looking at sports were established a long, long time ago, we seem to be inventing a new one here, which is going to give rise to every bit as much of a problem.
It's probably going to be more of a problem. I mean, because it's a concussion every time that they do it. I mean, I don't understand the logic of somebody who came up with this idea of, oh, let's have two great big men, usually rugby players, running at each other at full pelt. And just basically, let's see who can knock the other one out first. I just don't understand the logic of it. It's just completely bonkers with everything that's in the news about head injuries and stuff. And I just cannot wrap my head around it at all. I really can't.
I mean, for me, I have seen quite a few of them, and I have commented on their actual Facebook page. Nothing, derogatory. Just asking, is there any help for the players, if you can call them competitors? Is there insurance for them? What's happening with them later in life? And I've never had a response from that. And the thing for me, if it's a tackling sport, if you like to call it, you don't see them tackling waist height. It's always chest and above. And the amount of people that I've watched, and both of them get knocked out at the same time, and then 20 minutes later they're walking around and, you know, interacting with everyone. It shouldn't be like that. And as you said, we seem to be making a new sport that's going to cause brain injuries for these competitors. And we know of one, I think he was a 17-year-old boy that was doing it with his friends, not competing or anything. Unfortunately, he died.
Yeah, that was in the media, that was.
Yeah. So...
yeah, so kids are copying it now. So, I mean, it's dangerous enough doing it as a sport, but you're encouraging kids to be doing it out on the field when they're out with their mates. I mean, it's just mind-blowing. It's probably the only one that I can't wrap my head around, and it needs to be banned. I just don't understand.
I don't see a safe way of doing that sport.
There isn't a safe. I won't even call it a sport. Go back to playing rugby and do that sort of thing.
You know, I couldn't believe it, to be honest, when I saw it. I thought, yeah, surely this isn't happening, but sadly it is. And also, sadly, we're running out of time, which is a real shame. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you both. We will get you back on the show. No problem. This story is going to continue and continue, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be going around a long while, yeah.
Yeah, but just know that, so anyone that's listening, we're here for you.
Yeah.
And thank you very much, Pete, for having us on the show.
No, it's been a pleasure. Rich and Jen, thank you so much for being my guests.
Thanks, Pete.
Thanks,
Pete.
Take
care.
Thanks so much to Jen and Rich, and I wish them all the best for the future. Do take a look at the website, marshalling-cte.co.uk. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition. Thanks for your company, and I hope you'll join me again soon for some more Dementia Talk right here on the D Word Podcast.